In this interview, we are joined by Felicia Mings and Jimily Malika, both based currently in Chicago. They're joining us on the phone.
Hi, my name is Felicia Mings. I am Canadian, grew up primarily in Thorold and St. Catharines, Ontario, and spent many years in Toronto and the GTA more broadly. My family is kind of African-Canadian roots, many generations back, as well as my dad's side is Jamaican, and then also my mom's side, we have Bajan heritage. And I live now in Chicago. I moved here in 2012 to do my master's at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago in visual and critical studies. And prior to graduating, or just shortly before, I gained a position at the museum, and I've kind of like my position's evolved. And so right now I'm the academic curator in the Department of Academic Engagement and Research here at the Art Institute.
Hi, my name is Jamila Malika Bubakari. I'm at SAIC currently, the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, graduate student in the writing program, thinking about text off page and hybrid forms.
Our first question asked our guests to reflect on the differences and the similarities between Toronto and Chicago, and we join them in conversation.
The Art Institute, the museum, which is where I now work, security personnel is primarily Black. Staff in, I guess, more kind of leadership and content-driven roles are not so much. And so the optics of that, I think, had a big effect on me a little bit in the beginning. Also, when I moved here was the year that Chicago became a, or not Chicago, I guess the state of Illinois became a conceal and carry state. So you had the like no smoking signs as no gun signs. And then just also the real like geography of the city. It's a bit more sprawling, I feel like, than Toronto in some ways. And you really feel the demarcation of a neighborhood. And so I think just on that kind of visceral level, navigating the city can, especially when you move here to be in kind of the bubble of the art world, can be quite shocking and different than what Toronto felt like to me. I don't know, Jamila, chime in anywhere.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's there are a lot of similarities between Toronto and Chicago, like the lakeshore and this really vibrant arts and culture scene. And, you know, like I grew up in Vancouver and there's an overground train here. There's a few things right away where I was like, oh, you know, this feels familiar. But that is, it's still America, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like I underestimated how strong some of the values are. You know, Thanksgiving weekend really kind of blew my mind. Everybody, you know, kind of was like, football, Black Friday, like food and family. And I think, you know, in Canada, a lot of the discourse is we talk about, you know, the land and colonial settlers and all these kind of histories that relate to it. And there weren't those kinds of conversations. And there's like a Trump building, like right up from the school. I feel like every time I go in and out of a building, you kind of see that. Mm-hmm. So Toronto, I don't know, like Chicago also has this narrative around being a shelter city and being very progressive, but those kinds of racial segregations that Felicia described were all really intense for me as well. Like, not only is the security all Black, but all of the janitorial staff are Black, and all the cafeteria staff are Black, and you're kind of moving around this space where, like, the plantation still feels like that history of America. It still feels really present, mm-hmm. and, you know, you go into the Target and all of the people working there are Black, and you hear people sirring white, you know, shoppers, and there's something like residual about the history of America, and, you know, this sharp capitalism, this kind of like individualism that mm-hmm. feels totally different than kind of like the healthcare and mm-hmm. all of the things that you're accustomed to. I have this like low-grade anxiety about needing medical help, you know, all the time, being a Canadian. And I'm like, what happens in America? And of course I have coverage through the school, but just those kinds of ideas become really real after being here for a few months.
And do you find that that creates a certain sense of isolation? Do you, either of you know, like, other Black Canadians? Or, and is that important, you know, moving through these spaces that are so, you know, segregated in a lot of ways?
I think I just found, I found African Americans that really just knew, two of my good friends know so much about Canada and spend a lot of time, like, visiting Toronto, one grew up in Michigan, that we could kind of have these conversations around these differences, because when I was at the school, I was writing my thesis on, like, emerging photographers in Toronto. I needed to kind of, like, academically think about these issues and these differences, so it was kind of, I guess, a useful exercise as opposed to something that made me feel like I was isolated and alone, because I had a reason to think through it and talk about it with others.
Yeah, I think I've had, like, a bit of a different experience. It's been really good. I have a couple friends in New York who are Black and brown and working in the arts and from Toronto, and I feel like that's been a nice place to kind of reconnect and talk about. You kind of commiserate, you know, like what it feels like to be here and have kind of a longing for a kind of, I don't know what the word is, but these, like, Canadian values that I think I left Canada feeling a little bit more critical about the state of affairs, and have had these conversations with friends in New York about how I'm returning to a real feeling of, like, I self-identify as a Canadian all the time. I hear myself be like, what? Yeah, I'm from Toronto in Vancouver. You know, I think it explains a lot in terms of the things that I believe and care about and want. You know, in a classroom or, like, in a social setting, it's kind of inclusivity that I really believe in. But I think I've had a few folks to reconnect with. And so the isolation, yeah, it's kind of drawn me back into some relationships where I feel like I can have that kind of feeling of community.
So earlier, one of you made a comment about the kind of conversations that are happening in Canada around colonization and the history and the impact, sort of saying that you didn't feel that that was in the conversation in Chicago. I'm curious, maybe Felicia first can comment on whether that's something you try to bring into the conversation, or if it feels like it's something that there just isn't a depth of engagement with.
Do happen, and I know that people have, like, I have students that I've worked with that host, like, this decolonization dinner every Thanksgiving or every American Thanksgiving at the school. And so for me, I think the conversations were really around, or the difference would be in thinking about Black experiences, I guess, the way that it's articulated in the States, and I think my difference is kind of trying to open up that conversation sometimes when I'm in certain circles to be more inclusive of the variants of ways that we exist and diasporic experiences, because I felt like Chicago has such a rich history in terms of, like, the Great Migration and civil rights movements, and there's so much to acknowledge and know about and contend with just in this one city alone. And then when you think of a larger African American experience, it sometimes doesn't take into account the other kind of Black diasporas that exist and the ways that they contribute to culture and history. And even though you have, like, Point de Salvo, who is Haitian, who, like, was the first Black person here in Chicago, right? So, whereas in the difference, I think, in Canada, whenever, even within the arts, there's a lot of, I think, focus on proving our existence and that we were here and we were always here. And yes, there's, like, recent waves of migration, but there's always this turn to kind of acknowledging that history of colonization and us being here.
Yeah.
Whereas in America, it's just a different dialogue that I think is normally taking place.
I just think it's interesting talking kind of about that proof of existence or proof of history. That's a really interesting point. Anyways, Jamila, go for it.
Yeah, I really agree with what Felicia is saying around this. Like, in Canada, you know, Blackness has all of these different iterations, and, like, West Indian and West African and, you know, folks from everywhere. And in the States, there is definitely, like, this rich culture of African Americanness, you know. And there's a lot of, I was digging into some of the conversations in art schools and School of Visual Arts, they had this big panel about white supremacy and erasure in the arts and institutions. And I think like that kind of conversation happens a little more, whiteness and erasure, and again, having to like prove this existence. But I think that caveat about colonialism and settler, that maybe is more of a Canadian conversation. But here I think people talk a lot about gentrification, which kind of seems like a variant on that to me. And like I live in Pilsen, and Pilsen is experiencing this. It's like really close to the downtown core, and so I think folks are edging in. And, you know, there's those same kind of symbols, like, you know, when's the Whole Foods going up, when's the gym going up, these condos are going up, and like what money and class do, because this neighborhood's been Mexican for so long, and it's a really rich culture here. So, yeah, I feel like there are different conversations, but I've been really seeking them out. I had this really interesting class called Psychoacoustics, and the prof identified as like a descendant of slaves. And at the end of the class, I had given this talk about being a black woman and speaking, and, you know, pitch and tone and room and conversations. And he said to me, you know, with emancipation, some black folks, they went from the south, they went north, you know, and then some of those black folks from the north, they wanted to go even further north. And he acknowledged that I don't, you know, my background is Nigerian and Trinidadian, but he felt like this relationship between how free I felt and that I was from Canada. You know, he was like, I feel like you really feel free. You feel free to say these things. And, you know, I feel like that kind of free feeling is something that he understands in this history of people moving from the south further north. And I thought that was such an interesting take.
It's interesting, that observation, the black history in Canada, and particularly this part of Canada, going back a long way, and people have been here for a long time, but particularly in relation to the Chicago area and that part of the U.S., and just in response to what you just said about, oh, you've come from Canada, so you must feel free, is, of course, the history of so many people who came here and then went back, right, that actually went back to Ohio and Chicago and those areas and Illinois and so on because of the segregation and racism that they confronted in this country. So that part of it, we talk about a lot of erasure, and as our artist Camille Turner talks about, and Charmaine Nelson, Dr. Charmaine Nelson, who we've interviewed as well from McGill, you know, there is this narrative of Canada being the end of the Underground Railroad, and that's the story. But there's a bigger narrative of what people who did come here, what they experienced and where they went afterwards. So that's just an aside around this sort of ongoing sense of like absence and erasure that continues. Felicia, could you talk a bit about the program that you're doing, like what you're leading in Chicago?
My role is academic curator, and one of the main things that I do is run the Andrew W. Mellon Summer Academy, an undergraduate curatorial fellowship program. And that is a project that is funded by the Mellon Foundation. And it began as a pilot project in 2013 at 5 institutions across the state. And we were just renewed for another 5-year grant in the fall of 2017. And a 6th institution was added into the consortium. So essentially, the Mellon Foundation and the American Art Museum Directors Association did a report that looked at the state of kind of leadership in American art museums and looked at the statistics, and basically found that, you know, leadership in American art museums doesn't reflect the population in terms of ethnocultural background, and how can we change that and really who becomes kind of leaders in these spaces. And so the program at all of our institutions is comprised of a week-long summer academy, which is an intensive for 15 undergraduate students, so typically freshmen, sophomores, or non-traditional students that have at least 2 years of their undergraduate degree remaining. And it's for students from underrepresented backgrounds to have the experience of getting specialized kind of intensive training in curatorial practice and really seeing how museums work. So they're exposed to conservation, to kind of publishing, art packing, all the different kind of networks of, I guess, career options that are connected to museums and curatorial practice. And then at the end of the week, students are invited to do a supplemental application and to two students are given a two-year curatorial fellowship where they have a curator as their mentor. They're on site roughly once a week during the academic year. They have two consecutive full-time summer internships and just kind of ongoing support to help them in their last 2 years of their undergraduate degree in terms of having experience within museums, be exposed to object-based research, and the kind of skills you would need to go on and pursue graduate studies, hopefully, and ideally go on to work in a museum in the future.
That's kind of incredible. I mean, you've gone to school here, you've worked within the center. Like, I'm kind of curious when you were talking about that, like in terms of looking at the institutional support that you've received through this program, it seems like there's just incredible support for underrepresented students and being able to create opportunities in leadership directions. Did you feel that sort of support in Canada?
I think it's a little bit different in Canada right now. I'd say in terms of like informal mentorship and reaching out to people and having people want to support young people of color kind of move through the ranks in terms of their art careers, mm-hmm. I've been completely fortunate in Canada and being able to find those kinds of supports. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's the same structural kind of grant focus on that. I know we have a lot more in Canada funding through government grants and things mm-hmm. like that, but I don't know that the private foundation world is as extensive as it is in the States, whereas the States doesn't have the same kind of government funding for the arts and relies heavily on things like, you know, the Ford Foundation, okay. the Terra Foundation, those spaces. And I also think that the way that conversations around race and class and things play out within Canada, it's not quite as constant and on the surface as it is in America. So here there's a constant, I feel like, recognition that people of color are not in these spaces. And in Canada, I think we are slowly getting better at recognizing the ways that we historically and still don't support our Indigenous communities, but mm-hmm. I think we don't even really have within our education system like an acknowledgement that slavery happened in Canada, right? We don't mm-hmm. talk about mm-hmm. The way that, you know, Chinese migrants built our Canadian railroads, like the ways that a multitude of communities of color have built this nation and also been kind of oppressed or and not really brought in to so many of the opportunities there. It's not a conversation at the level that it is in the States. And so I don't feel like we have, I mean, maybe there are programs, but I'm not aware of programs that are as extensive as this. And our museum, the Art Institute, just also got another grant called the Diversifying Art Museum Leadership Initiative, which my department is involved with. And that's a grant by the Ford Foundation and the Walton Family Foundation, where they funded 20 institutions across the state, again, around kind of diversifying museum leadership. So the kind of same premise as the undergraduate program that I work on. And so I think there's this real desire to contend with the ethical issues of not having these fields represent the nation. But then there's also the real financial need to be able to recognize that the populations within many cities are changing, and you need to sustain these spaces. And so you can't rely on the same kind of families and donors to have their kids back to become a member of your institution, you know, 20 years from now, because that's not the case. And so there's a real desire to make people see themselves as represented within the institution's programming and exhibitions, but also through who's reflected in kind of leadership roles. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Canada's there.
Yeah, I was going to comment my once-a-day critique of the Archive of Ontario. Usually I just do it home over coffee talking to the cat, but it's interesting what you were saying about what's going on in the United States and the support that's there, the realization in these institutions, change, both recognizing the historic diversity in communities, but also change. So something has to change in the leadership of these institutions, the irony of a place like AGO at this moment, 2018, in a city like Toronto, that it decides to hire both a white male American director who then hires a white male British via the United States chief curator at this moment. So it seems there's the irony of all that is sad, but not lost.
Do you think, and this can be for both, this is something that's come up in other conversations, is that this sort of history of invisibility, which like tangible visibility of certain histories not being taught, particularly you brought up the history of slavery isn't taught, that what it leads to is people not asking those tough questions when they walk into a museum or a school. If you don't know that history, then you're not necessarily going to ask why communities aren't represented or why people aren't there, where it is so much more obvious in the United States when there is an absence. Do you think that's a fair comment?
I mean, I learned a lot of those kinds of things in my house growing up, you know, and it wasn't lost on me, these kinds of seeing, you know, white male ownership and privilege. But I don't know, sometimes I wonder about, I'm moved by the work that Felicia does, because sometimes I don't even expect a museum, you know, like the history and symbolism of a museum, to really start asking those tough questions. I was just thinking about Sandra Perry's work around museums, and she has a video piece about resemblance and representation that's really great, that delves into those tough questions. I'm always, you know, surprised when an institution like a museum does that work. I kind of assume, you know, that galleries, you know, that the AGO is hiring in this way. It almost doesn't surprise me,
right.
You know? I don't know if institutions are often the spaces where we get to kind of ask those big questions and push back. For me, those conversations have always been like in my community and in my home.
Right.
Maybe, Jamila, you could talk about the work you're doing and direction you're going. And
yeah, I'm here just thinking about text off page, text as soundscapes, and text as installation or projection, looking at video, thinking about ways to tell stories. I had a bit of a hard time in my first couple weeks or couple months here. I was drawn into four meetings with faculty about curriculums and kind of classroom or like pedagogies around how conversations are happening in classrooms, and you know, if marginalized people are just being further marginalized because of the ways that teachers maybe don't mediate comments and questions and content. So I feel like my work last semester really started looking at the space that Black women get to take up in conversation. I was looking a lot at work by, you know, there's like some cool artists who are doing a lot of great work where they're commenting using visual arts as platforms, because I think it's, you might not get the same kind of respect or attention when you just have these interventions and conversations. But if I look at like Camila Janan Rashid's work, she did that great poster series, How to Suffer Politely.
Yeah,
that was really awesome. And, you know, or if you think back a while ago, like Adrian Piper's work, or, mm-hmm. you know, there's Alexandra Bell in New York, she's mm-hmm. doing these great counter-narratives where she redacts the New York Times. And I went to an opening at The Kitchen. It's a retrospective on Julius Eastman, and that's a really, you know, like the story of this beautiful Black queer jazz composer who was known by his contemporaries but like died in 1990 quite unknown, and now there's this kind of renewed interest in his work. And so all of these amazing artists, Camila included, and Tiona Nakia McLaudden, who works in film and video and new media, Shawnee Micheline Holloway, who works in new media as well, Sandra Perry, who works in new media, they're finding ways through arts to really talk about race and inclusion and who we kind of find disposable and leave out. But I feel like there's a lot of room using the arts to kind of say things that don't really get, you know, that I was really struggling to say in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and not really finding like that there was space for that. So the work that I'm doing is really, I feel like I'm learning more of these technical skills to kind of make these interventions without using myself as a voice box, mm-hmm. or being on stage. And I feel like kind of removing the visual of myself, it might mean I'm able to say more.
I really love, too, that with Camila and Alex Bell's work, that they are also engaging their direct communities with the work they're doing. Alex Bell's work was just in a show at the Contact Gallery here in Toronto.
Oh.
Really excited about the fact that they're kind of taking up spaces that aren't necessarily through the institution, the museum, or the specific art gallery.
Yeah.
I think there's, I'm kind of interested in, like, how do we take up space through art in different ways, differently?
I think that's important. I'm taking a class this semester about public space and light and using projection on public space, and Camila's work was, and Alex's work is really like in the street, these like big posters, murals on walls, and it kind of brings back that idea of, you know, who's going into museums, who's running museums, and in the interim, while we're like doing the work of changing those spaces, like the street is a really great space to kind of engage in these conversations with everybody.
We were talking to Cyrus Marcus Ware recently. He's really, you know, committed to love as being the center of his activist work. And I kind of feel like this is the same thread through Alex Bell's work and Camila's. I mean, so many artists' work, but specifically, I really think it's really interesting to look at the ways that you can engage in terms of looking at institutions and the work that you're doing, navigating the world that you're in, but being able to share that in another way. I just think that it's not only are you trying to kind of provoke or challenge the public, I think that it's a way of sharing.
Yeah, I just thought really when you were speaking about that instance, I don't know if it was last year, but Jelani Morgan took the pictures of the Black Lives Matter. Yeah, right? These folks, and then somebody shredded one of the pictures, right?
Yeah.
And then they really made this beautiful action of sewing back up the photographs. Like, in these photographs were, what, on King Street? Like, they were really public. And so it kind of made me think also David Hammond's had that How You Like Me Now work. This well, when you put work in the street, people can respond to it, and then you kind of get to respond back. So Hammond put up that white Jesse Jackson, and then some kids took hammers to it and tore it down, and then he put it back up with these sledgehammers over it. This kind of conversation you get to have with folks when you put your work out there in this really public way.
Yeah.
So, Felisa, can you talk a bit about following those that conversation about the art and the art out in public space and relationship to community, maybe examples of some of the work that the students coming to work with you and are doing to think about how the institution relates to the community?
Well, I'd say at this point we have 45 alumni from our summer academy, and I'm in touch with them to various degrees. We do cohort events at least quarterly where they're invited back for talks or events or tours, and then some also reach out to me on a more frequent basis. And I would say some know a lot about curating in museums and some just have an interest, and so we take in students that are, you know, majoring in American studies, interested in policy work, English, studio art, that the way that they go back and have, I think, their time affects or, have an effect on the work they do really varies. I think of one student, though, or a few, actually, that are just, I think if they're committed to working in communities, that's just something that they continue to do. So I can think of one student, Katia Perez, who has been involved on her campus. Well, she goes to SAIC and has been involved with the kind of Latinx affinity group there. She's been a part of mural projects in the Pilsen community and has just kind of continued to do work within the arts, and she also makes work. And I find that when we have students here for the week, one of the days is always looking at institutions outside of the Art Institute. So we spend a day in the south side of Chicago primarily thinking about Hyde Park as a case study for curating in communities. So that day is often, we might go to the DuSable Museum of African American History. We might go to the Southside Community Arts Center, which has a rich history of having people like Gordon Parks, Charles White, you know, really significant African American artists that learned through that center, taught other artists in that center. There's a real kind of circulation of
African-American artists that went to SAIC that were also connected to the Southside Community Arts Center. And I find that that day of looking at the way that you can be a teacher, the way that you could curate and do this work in different types of spaces, to often be the most impactful in terms of the comments we receive back. And so I think things like that, like allowing them to see a major institution is great, and the kind of collections we have can be really useful for you in terms of learning about culture in different places and informing your own research and practice, whether you're an artist or an academic or whatever path you want to take. But there's also gems of spaces across the city. You know, Chicago has an amazing apartment gallery scene, and so I feel like the students really plug into the plethora of ways that they can engage with art in their own communities and other communities across Chicago.
You did the curatorial intensive with ICI, right, in New Orleans?
I did, yeah, 2015. That was amazing.
In terms of your work, because I mean, I know you're the academic curator, do you feel that there is, like, is there work that you're doing outside of your work with the school? And do you find your, like, do you find that you have balance within your work, like in your career? Like, are you going in kind of like one direction with the school, and are you curating on the side?
Well, I'm an academic curator at the Art Institute as in the museum, so I don't work, I did my master's at the school, but I work at the museum now. And there's definitely not a balance in my life yet. I haven't quite achieved that. I think I'm really fortunate that I get to work on a show at the Art Institute, which I've never done before. I'm co-curating a show with our chair of African art and a contemporary curator that will open in November 2019. So I think it's nice to be able to think through curriculum and curatorial practice and support young people of color in kind of entering that field, but also to be able, I think the best teachers are practitioners, but mm-hmm. to be able to actually do this work in our institution is really significant and important for me. Mm-hmm. But I also try to maintain a balance of outside projects, and I don't know that I do the greatest job. I'm a curatorial fellow for ACRE, which is an amazing residency program in Chicago. I mean, their headquarters in Chicago, but they have a farm in Wisconsin. And so all the artists that go through this kind of, I think, 2 or 3 week residency, they bring in people to do critiques. And as a curatorial fellow, you have the opportunity, you kind of like do a lottery and you curate a show of the artists that you're given out of the ones that you came to meet. And so that's like a very outside project that I'm excited about because it allows me, I think, really have more of a pulse on the contemporary practices that are happening in the city and a little bit beyond, as opposed to just kind of the artists that we're able to bring into a major institution. So mm-hmm. that's nice, and to work with artists that are, I guess, a little bit more like establishing themselves to some extent. Mm-hmm. It's fun. I had done a fellowship, I guess, or a research fellowship in South Africa, trying to think about the ways that equity maps into curatorial practice, because I thought the conversations would be a bit more frank, and they were, and I'm still kind of in the midst of transcribing all my interviews from that. So I feel like having a balance of thinking around, I guess, pedagogy of curatorial practice and how mm-hmm. equity maps into that, and also furthering my own interest in researching and writing about contemporary art of the African diaspora and trying to create opportunities to curate that is, they align, but they're also different endeavors, and I haven't quite found the spot of balancing that yet. But opportunities like ICI are really nice ways to kind of meet other colleagues and think through some of those questions. So I found that to be a really fruitful space to be in. Mm-hmm.
I think probably the most consistent response we've had in terms of trying to figure out a balance in every artist or a curator or scholar's life is that it just doesn't seem to exist. How do we maintain the work you're doing and make sure that you're kind of able to continue on?
One of the things about writing is you just kind of figure out how you write, when you write, where you write. And there's so much inspiration, I feel like, in the just kind of going to and fro around in the city. I do so much people watching, you know, like writers are always kind of watching, and I feel like I always get off the subway and something happens and I just want to write about it. So I feel like I do have a practice of sitting down in the mornings and getting some writing done, and I also often feel really moved by these, you know, moments of observation, of watching people interact and, or not, you know, ignore each other. There's a lot of really beautiful Black folks who beg around the school who really move me, and I'm trying to think about ways to work with them or record them or get their consent. And yeah, I feel like there's a lot of inspiration also, you know, with the keeping your regular practice, because it's just like working a muscle, you know, just kind of keep writing. But I really miss working with young people in high schools, which is something I used to do with New Leaf Yoga in Toronto, teaching mindfulness and trauma-informed yoga. So I found a fellow here, Mashan Ali. He does restorative justice, and he looks at kind of money that moves around the incarceration. He makes a line of hoodies that say crime pays. He's really thinking hard about looking differently at like why we pay police, what we pay police, what do jails generate in terms of money. And he works with a group of young fellas, and I'm going to be doing mindfulness with them. And yeah, so I feel like for me, doing the work, feeling inspired, and also kind of being of service with young folks of color is really important. You know, I have a steady kind of meal prep Sunday practice. You know, I feel like the ways that I make sure that I'm fueled up and well-rested for the week are the simplest and often most important to me. So, yeah, it's I'm still really trying to kind of figure out this school life, this Chicago life, and making sure that I take care of myself has just been kind of this day-to-day getting into a routine, making sure I get to the gym, making sure I get to bed, you know? It's kind of really those practical things that are making all the difference in this transition. I don't know that I do a great job at this yet. I think there's a lot of, like, energy and I think emotional labor that goes into comporting yourself in certain spaces, being one of few people of color. And I think that I don't necessarily always give myself time to, like, unpack that and really rest from the week sometimes, which can be a challenge. But I guess little things that I do is I have a WhatsApp group with two of my best friends that are not in the arts and they don't live in Chicago. One is actually a clinical psychologist and the other is a journalist. But so the clinical psychologist is always telling me about self-care and telling me I need to rest. And so I have friends that are good at reminding me that I just need to slow down. And I think I have a really great community of friends here as well. And one thing that I try to do, which, you know, as you get busy, you tend to not do the self-care stuff that you should kind of maintain, but one is Sunday dinners that I used to do monthly with two of my friends who curate independently, but also work within kind of the intersection of curatorial practice, education, working with young people. So we would get together, and I would spend, like, a day cooking, like, some kind of Caribbean dish that my grandma would make, but I never learned, so I would kind of call her and grocery shop and look at recipes, and they're not from the Caribbean, so they pretty much are happy with whatever I make. We'd kind of just slow down and get to, like, relax by cooking, and then we would talk about, you know, maybe challenges at work or ideas that we want to critique among each other around, you know, exhibition ideas that we have, and so that's, like, a really, I feel like, rejuvenating space for me, but maybe one that I don't work to create as often as I should anymore. And then I think this the same as Jamila in terms of, like, trying to exercise, going to sleep early, making sure I grocery shop so that I'm, like, having meal plans and eating healthy during the week as opposed to having to buy food out and eating whatever crap is nearby. So simple things like that are also it for me. And then I guess also trying, or at least for this year, really trying to think of my, like, holistic development. I think I looked back at 2017 and was really proud of things that I accomplished, but they often had to do with work or traveling somewhere, as opposed to, you know, learning to read music or something that just allows me to grow as an individual outside of the work I'm doing. And so I'm trying to create more space for that, for just kind of living independent of, you know, a job or a practice.
I am a part of a Black study group that is outside of school, but it's just a small group of people that get together once a month for Sunday dinners as well. Just having that one study has really been, like, such a savior to my mental health. And I just think that it's interesting that we kind of all talked about those kind of things, like just looking for that one maybe repetitive thing that allows us to feel connected.
I was going to comment as we wrap up that actually this is the third week, Sunday in a row, Sunday afternoon that Liz and I have met just here and had conversations with folks. I wish we could continue every Sunday. I wish that was
yeah, it's a good
Sunday routine. We would just have to add a dinner meal or something. But it actually has been the conversations have been a really rich grounding, right? To hear people be so generous and share so much as you two have today. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you guys. This has been great.